General Motors CEO Mary Barra is going to meet with Larry Kudlow, the National Economic Council director, here at the White House today in regard to GM's announcement about those layoffs and plant rearrangements.
Home builders getting demolished Thursday after D.R. Horton's warning of weaker demand. The ITB Home Construction ETF now down 27% for the year.
I would be very, very surprised if we had a major slowdown. The only thing that could trigger it, in my view, would be a political accident. The underlying fundamentals still look pretty good. Yes, the fiscal stimulus is going to wear off a little. That will lead to slower headline growth. The Fed will probably hike a few more times, which may restrain credit at the margin. But the underlying fundamentals, rising employment, still strong business confidence, point to sustained gains in demand in the US and elsewhere.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, a positive week for the stock market this week. That's not the way it began. GM announces it's going to cut 15,000 workers and shut down a couple of its plants. And are we at risk of a housing recession as housing appears it is slowing down, as higher interest rates start to bite, talks of a recession, and the Fed chairman gets a little bit dovish? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. As I mentioned, a positive week for the markets. Robin Griffith will be joining me in the first hour. He said the markets have lost progressively some of the upswing, and he says the FANG run is over. It's not saying it's going to stop, but we're not going to see the momentous type climb in the FANG stocks going forward. You are seeing a rotation in the markets, he believes, and storm clouds are coming in the future for global debt, but at least not right now. And he's going to talk about if you have to put money to work, there's only one place to put it, and that's in the U.S. So Robin will be joining me in hour one. Also joining me at the end of the hour, the bottom half, will be Robert Rapier, as he adds another dimension as to that steep decline in oil prices as we've seen over the last month. He said the Chinese, as a result of trade war, stopped buying 500,000 barrels of American oil. So that is adding to some of the buildup that you've been seeing in some of these weekly reports. He said the president blinks and OPEC is more likely to cut oil production. Oil prices, according to Robert, the fundamentals have not changed at oil, and there are some very attractive buys in the sector. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And coming up in hour two, the markets have become more volatile this year despite record corporate profits and a booming economy. One would think, with economic and financial conditions this good, the stock market would be doing much better than it has. So why so much volatility? And why is it that this year you can feel rich one month and then poor the next? Well, in hour two, we're going to be answering those questions in what we call things to worry about. Then in the next segment of today's big picture, we look at Trump versus OPEC, with the markets that are now worried that a new oil glut is forming as the U.S. is clearly becoming more of a force and the U.S. president, in this case Trump, gaining more power as a result. All of that coming up in hour two, the big picture. And now it's time for our weekly wrap-up report with Ryan Poplava.
Well, thank you, Chris. We've had some feedback internally to try a more abbreviated and punchy wrap-up for the show, so I'm going to give it a try for a few weeks and hope to hear any feedback from our listeners on that new approach. Please feel free to email me at ryan.poplava, P-U-P-L-A-V-A, at financialsense.com. So let's go into it. One of the key catalysts this week was a speech from Fed Chairman Jerome Powell on Wednesday. The moment he mentioned rates were just below normal, the S&P 500 rallied 0.8%, and this was a big step back from the comments he made on October 3rd that we were a long ways away from neutral. This was important because if you recall some of my discussions earlier in the podcast since October, the Fed officials were predicting 3 rate hikes next year, and that was well above the market's expectations, as evidenced by some of our discussion about the Fed fund futures and that has helped to flatten the yield curve since that September meeting. Jerome also mentioned that the Fed will be paying close attention to incoming economic data. So essentially, it's possible the Fed may be nearing a near-term pause in 2019. Now, Powell's comments led to one of the strongest equity rallies we've seen this year, up 2.3% for the S&P 500. In fact, the second strongest. And the FOMC minutes out this week further corroborated with this statement that many committee members are considering an adjustment in language from further gradual rate increases to basically an emphasis on evaluating incoming data or data dependent. So the minutes also hinted that rate increases from here might be adjusted down to 20 basis points from what they've been doing at 25 basis points. This in combination with a soft PCE core prints, that's inflationary data, of a price increase of only 0.1% versus 0.2% in October has led to a rally in treasury prices and a drop in rates. Now, November was looking like the seasonal standard rally was just going to pass us along, but Jerome Powell basically came to the rescue. Now, the next key item this week was trade soundbites from Trump in the Wall Street Journal. In an interview and articles that all throughout the week. Now, Trump said, we are close to a deal, but he isn't sure he wants one because he said, what we have right now is a good deal, getting, of course, income from China on those tariffs. Now, this came off earlier comments this week that he mentioned it's highly unlikely that he will refrain from the planned rise in tariffs from 10 to 25%. That's set to hit, Chris, in January. Now, the Wall Street Journal later in the week cited from unnamed sources that both sides are considering forestalling any more tariffs through the spring to set the stage for further discussion. So that's one possible outcome we may see this weekend from the G20. The hope is that anything, any kind of small victory that we may be possibly de-escalating the trade war, you know, that could really seriously affect investors happily could see some major rallies in equities. And another place that could really stand to benefit from that is the retail industry and the Chinese equities. You know, they stand to benefit the most from really a pause in trade war escalations. But not to mention equities as a whole for both countries. So those were the two key stories this week, Chris. But other areas worth mentioning are oil down briefly below $50 a barrel for West Texas Intermediate. And there also this week, there was another draw in natural gas inventories, holding natural gas prices high, with inventories near the low range of their five-year average. And that's what's going on right now in energy. And of course, transports are benefiting from that energy's weakness, as that's been one of the strongest groups in the market for November, with the Dow Jones transports up around 6%. Now, OPEC will meet next week to discuss possibly a cut. So that's where things could possibly turn around for the price of oil, which has been just straight down now for several weeks. One last thing to mention, Chris, this week is some interesting economic data. New home sales declined 8.9% in October over September. And at the current sales pace, there is around 7.4 months of supply of new homes for sale. That's the highest since January 2011. So it's very possible that this could be a warning for home builders that prices may come down. Now, that's the market wrap up for this week, Chris. And all eyes are on Buenos Aires and the Trump and President Xi meeting this Saturday night. But hopes have been tempered by many articles this week that, again, Trump is happy with the way things are at and doesn't feel really any kind of pressure to move forward on any kind of deal, unless it's, of course, one that he's very happy with.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Per our release of the Case-Shiller S&P CoreLogic House Price Index yesterday, we've seen six straight months now where the pace of price increases is slowing. It's not turned negative. So, you know, let's just be very clear here. Prices are still growing at about 5.5% on a year over year basis. So, you know, that's not bad. If you ask anyone if they would like, you know, their house to appreciate 5.5% year over year, they'd probably say okay. But the reason why we're starting to be a little concerned about the housing market is that, number one, that's come down 6 straight months. Other indicators, particularly existing home sales, although they were up a little bit last month, they've also seen a 6-month slide. And as you mentioned, inventory is up. And just today, we saw the new home sales are down almost 9% year over year. So it is pretty clear that we're at this inflection point. And to your question, what's going on? Well, you know, our best take now is that it's really about supply and demand coming into balance.
Well, for investors in 2018, it's been a tale of two kind of markets. One month you feel rich, the next month you feel poor. Where's this market headed? Has a bear market begun? Or is this simply a correction? Joining us on the program is Robin Griffith. Let's begin our discussion with the major indexes. And I want to talk about the NASDAQ, which was the high flyer. That's where the fangs are. That's where the technology stocks are. And recently, the 50-day moving average crossed below the 200-day moving average. I wonder if you might tell us, how significant is that? Is that something investors should be concerned about?
Yes, it is. That's called a dead cross. I think it may have been Joe Granville that used that terminology years ago. But as a series of things, the market loses upwards momentum. Then it falls back enough to break the 200-day line. And then it falls more such that the 50 makes the dead cross signal. So there's really some downwards momentum now. That's a break. That is usually more than just a correction in a bull market. In fact, right at the beginning of the year, I look at 40 different world markets, and all of them were in an uptrend. So we started the year with a globally coordinated equity bull market. And when I rank all sites of asset classes, equities were the one right at the top of the list. And progressively, we've slowly lost them. And the last one to break down was the US market. But I mean, the emerging markets broke much earlier in the year because they had made a mistake. They'd borrowed a lot of US dollars when the dollars were cheap, and the rate of interest they paid on it was very low. So they've had a double squeeze of those two things have both risen. And then when Donald came in with his trade war, slapping tariffs on, they got slapped again in a way they weren't expecting. So poor old Turkey, which is probably the one that got it's off more than 30%. That's a major bear market it's in. And most of the other emerging markets went. And then, almost entirely because of the trade war, even the giant markets like India and China started to break down and give dead cross signals. In the case of the USA, it only broke in what is always the seasonally weakest part of the year. Most people know that the seasonal deviation goes sell in May and go away. You get a midsummer rally. And if it's going to go all nasty and wobbly, it does it between mid-September and late October. That is precisely when we got the terminal weakness in the U.S. market indices. Now we're in the strong season of the year, and the U.S. market is the one that's got a chance of going back up again and possibly making – there are circumstances whereby it could make new highs next year. But I think what has ended is the period of time led by the fangs. That's over now. That is well and truly over. We're not saying the fangs are going to go bust or anything like that, but what they're likely to do is come down to a valuation basis that makes sense in what we used to call the old normal. As we know, in the new normal, we should have bought Amazon on 800 times earnings, and we would have done jolly well in the last 2 years. But now that's not going to happen anymore. I think collectively, the fangs have lost $1 trillion in market cap, you know, very recently. I get confused with the difference between billions and trillions. They're just so many. They've really broken down though, And we've seen this before. I mean, back in the 60s, it was the Nifty 50. This time around, it's the FANGs. And what happens is the tendency for a lot of money to become passive and index-linked herds people, whether they wanted to or not, into the large market cap stocks that dominate the index. And of course, and it drives those multiples to unsustainably high levels. And when it breaks because the giant funds, there's no one big enough the other side of the market to take them out when they want to come out. So I think we can be quite clear that the period of dominance for the FANG stocks, which, as you say, dominates the NASDAQ index particularly, that's over now. And they will slowly settle down with rallies, but to a level where their businesses is valued on a way that is sustainable, and they'll probably start paying dividends and all that, those sorts of good things. I can certainly see elsewhere in America buying power rotating into businesses which we understand with the value hat on. And they tend to be conservative businesses, consumer durables, the utilities, these sorts of things. Businesses you can't live without that do pay dividends and where the multiple is much more sustainable. I think that's what we're seeing.
Robin, I want to talk also before we get to this rotation, and I'll come back to that. But explain for our listeners what happens when you have a severe downdraft. For example, we were hitting records in September as we were in January, and then you give it back so quickly. What does that do to investor psychology?
It breaks it. I think you'll find that confidence is it now at a very low level, even though the U.S. economy is in pretty good shape. Certainly relative to other economies, it's in very good shape. The confidence has nonetheless gone. There's a willingness to sit on maximum amounts of cash or to buy only very cautious investments. And I think we've already had what was the longest running bull market in recorded history. We all knew we were on borrowed time. It wasn't going to last forever or even much longer. Although, as I say, the U.S. market probably will get into next year before the final high. But the rest of the world is already no longer in a bull market. The rate of growth of the global economy is clearly slowing down. It's slowing down from pretty good numbers. I mean, India is still growing at about 8%. China, even its slowdown form, is growing at about 6%. And the USA, what, 4.5%, which is a pretty good number for a thing the size of the USA. But over here in Europe, you know, even the powerful German economy is not growing anymore. We're slowing right down, wither out all the Brexit trouble. It's a mess. And then you've got globally the demographic thing, you know, retiring baby boomers aren't going to be driving anything for a while. And the next generation is too small to drive anything. And even the millennials who will drive a boom, they're not really old enough to be in the driving seat just yet. So we're going to go through a bumpy period. And I'm very conscious that wise men like Ray Dalio are going out of his way to point out to the world, look, guys, I can see something pretty nasty in our future. I don't think it's just yet, but down the road, we can hear this storm coming. Make sure you're positioned to survive that. And I'm a huge fan of Ray Dalio and his company. And I think it's the debt mountain. The global debt mountain is a real problem. And seeing that, knowing that, confidence in the investment public is becoming quite unconfident, very nervy, basically.
So let's go back to this rotation that you were beginning to get into. Normally, you know, for the last 2 years, you've had the FANG stocks, technology stocks, almost look like a one-way trade going back to the tech boom. That's over. When you see things like this happen and the momentum trade fades, do we shift more to value from momentum? In other words, people are looking for stocks that are beaten up, that are good businesses, that represent good value, dividend plays, low PE ratios. Is that where we're heading?
Yes, it is. Normally, when everybody accepts, okay, we've had a bull market, we're at the top, we're now going into a bear market, the big switch is sell equities, buy government bonds. And if anybody believed that the U.S. economy was about to roll slowly over into a recession, they would be moving back into government bonds. And globally, that would be going on as well. This is where it becomes more complicated, though. It is quite obvious that the U.S. economy is growing really quite well. Donald's trade war is certainly put the U.S. in a stronger position than before. It was always considered that when the unemployment number gets to 4%, that's called full employment. Well, it's about 3.7% now. So, and the economy is still creating new jobs at a pretty decent rate. So what that's going to bring through is wage rises, which is inflation. And while that is going on, the Fed are most unlikely to back away from hiking rates. And you know the old joke that bull markets don't die of old age. They get shot in the head by the Fed hiking rates. They're on an agenda to do that. But at the moment, the Fed are lagging well behind the curve. They themselves publish a chart of interest rates using the Taylor rule, which is sort of where interest rates ought to be. And they actually are lagging well behind where the Taylor rule says at the moment. The Taylor rule is predicting about 4.3%. And the Fed are deliberately nowhere near that level. And although they're rising, they're still deliberately lagging back because they don't want to shoot the bull in the head just yet. They want to have a bit of scope, though, to lower interest rates at some later date when the economy really does start coming down. So we're in this conundrum that the stock market looks as though it's trying to roll from bull to bear, but the economy doesn't look like it's rolling from strong to weak just yet. And for that reason, investors don't want to come out of equities and go only into bonds. They want to buy some other equities, and that's why they're seeking value and dividends and franchises, which, however much volatility we've got to live through, we can't live without these things anyway. But what they haven't gone into things like gold and precious metals. They're not that frightened. They are sitting on quite a lot of cash, but the U.S. dollar's been so strong that it's a jolly good asset. If you're going to sit on any cash, make sure it's in dollars. You certainly don't want your cash in euros or sterling. So I think this is what it is. People know it's the top, but it isn't the top of the economy yet. It's very much, in the U.S., a stock market correction. The economy is likely to stay strong for another 12 months anyway. But looking further ahead than that, the Ray Dalios of this world are pointing out there is going to be a proper correction. That'll be a big one. And just averaging past bear markets, how big are they? I mean, I use the numbers 25, 33, and 50%. That bear markets are a quarter, a third, or a half. And so we could be due for a 50% bear market.
Wow.
But that doesn't look as though it's going to take place in 2019, though. It's more like, on my work, if I had to sort of stick my neck out to make a prediction, is the U.S. market will probably rise into the new year, but the stocks that are doing the running will be rotated over. And it'll probably stay strongish well into 2019. But once we get into the period 2020 to 2023, I don't think we're going to be able to avoid really quite a nasty bear market. And it will be global. It won't be just a U.S. phenomenon. It's going to be a global bear market. And that's when you'll want to spread your assets into all different types of asset classes. And equities would be a relatively small proportion of the total because they're the ones that have been pumped up onto valuation bases, which anyone who studied Benjamin Graham's books, we wouldn't be owning stocks at these levels anyway. You know, by old standards of value, equity markets are too pumped up. They really are. They're the wrong price.
Robin, let's talk about something like this. When you're in this situation where you've got this volatility, you have all these cross currents, you know, as you mentioned, the U.S. economy is still doing well, but further down the road, we know a storm is coming. And Ray Dalio has recently written in his book talking about a global debt crisis. He sees that on the horizon. If you're an average investor, What do you do right now? Because, I mean, you know, Dalio's firm is pretty sharp. They have a great track record. They know how to position themselves. What does the average guy do? Because most average investors are in index funds and passively invested.
Yeah. The merit of index funds that won't go away is that they charge very low fees. And that's good. The bad bit of them is it herds you into the few FANGs or Nifty 50s. And I think you do need to dilute that weighting right now. So you should be taking profits while they're still there in at least the FANG stocks and going into a spread of equities. So not, you know, no big bets, lots of little bets. And you also need to spread your asset classes. Diversification is the great way of trying to take risk off, but still get a return on your money. One of the things is, if you own a market when it's going up passively, but don't own it when it's coming down, using something as simple as the 200-day moving average to get you in when it goes above it and get you out when it comes below it, that algorithm alone doubles the return that you will make rather than just being passive the whole way through. You don't have to predict a boom. You just don't own the market for the whole of a bear correction. So as we are already below the 200-day moving average with a dead cross in place, I would be lightening up holdings on equities, particularly on the very excessively highly valued ones. But it, especially in America, it's too early just to say, I'm out, you know, I'm going to sit on cash. That's only ever going to be a short-term parking place. But you're going to want to own some other asset classes. And at the moment, bonds, corporate bonds, sometimes we used to call them junk bonds, but some junk is better than others. And it does actually pay you a decent dividend, which you're not getting off the equity market. I also think a geographical spread is worth doing so that you don't have it all in your own home market. You put it abroad. And if I had to stick my neck out, think where in the next 10 years will there be the best, most stable growth we can find? My two markets would be India, where the demographics are awesome. And there has already been a reasonable correction in India to make it better value than it was. And I have total confidence not a lot will go wrong there. And the other one, which is a high-tech value market, which is well-placed to participate in the growth in Asia, is actually Japan. So owning the Japanese market is another way of spreading risk geographically. So these are the sorts of things we'd be saying. In the case of us Brits, it's easy. All we've got to do is to get out of the pound and own some dollars. But to an American citizen, that advice doesn't add any value at all. But over here, it works great.
Robin, let's talk about another asset class, commodities. If you take a look at the commodity markets, they've been terrible this year, with the exception of oil. And now oil is looking pretty dismal. I mean, that was a severe waterfall decline that we got in 1 month. So what's your take on commodities?
Well, in the work that I do, I use an exchange-traded fund, which is energy-related investment. And although it's got oil as such in it, it's got other energy-related commodities as well. And it's holding up much better than the price of oil. I still think that on the energy-related area is good. But the precious metals, they've improved a little bit, but they're not great. Specifically, gold needs to go above $1,283 an ounce. And then I think you'd find people would be loving it. The reason that why one might buy some precious metals is simply as a risk diversifier. You put a little bit into it, not to make money, but in case things go pear-shaped in a way we can't predict, you've got another asset class. But right at the bottom, if the global economy is cooling down, and it clearly is, and Donald's trade war tariff thing is not encouraging it to do anything other than that, then for the moment, the commodity markets are still going to stay very soft. But now that the midterm elections have come and gone, it is entirely within Mr. Trump's remit to suddenly say, you know what, guys, I'm going to go and talk to President Xi. I think we can do a deal. And we, America, will come out of this deal really well, much better than we were a year ago. And he's, secondly, if he can persuade the Fed, you know what, guys, I think our economy risks slowing down. Why don't you stop hiking rates like you've been doing? Let's just sort of wait a bit. And I think, you know, if the numbers, the Fed could easily buy that, you'd suddenly find, hey, guys, the market's ready to rise again. And I think that is very much a possibility. So, but what it would do would give the U.S. equity bull market one more last leg, not with an enormous amount of dynamism, but it's just possible you could go up. You see, the difference between a market low and a market high is a bear market bottom is nearly always an event. It makes a sort of V shape on the chart. And you can look back and say that was the low. We could do that in 2009 really quite easily. That was the bottom that day. With tops, it's not like that. The top is much more of a slowly rolling loss of momentum and different themes come up. So you make several sort of spiky things like the top to a range of mountains. And it's only much later you can say, oh, that was the highest high. That was the actual top. But it's sort of rolling in a top type format already, isn't it? But all I'm saying is that in the case of the U.S., the final high may not quite be in place because the Donald's clearly got the ability to stop the trade war, which is part of the bad news. And the Fed could easily go easy on the hiking. And in fact, I've got a chart of the probability of 3 rate hikes next year. And it's already dropped to about 30%. It was looking like a slam dunk only a month or two ago. Now it's looking like a 30% probability. And it's only got to get to the, you know what, we're not going to hike anytime soon. And suddenly, I think you'd find the equity market would pick up quite dramatically.
That could come as soon as actually next month if they raise rates as expected. But saying, you know what, we're just going to sit back and kind of watch things for a while. Robin, basically what you're saying here is the peak in the economy isn't here yet. So that makes it maybe less likely we've hit a peak in stocks. There's a rotation taking place from the momentum more to reasonably value type stocks. If you are a passive investor, it may be time to take some profits off the table while you have them and start diversifying into different asset classes because we don't know that storm. I use the analogy, you're on the beach in Florida. It looks a nice sunny day, but you know off the coast of Africa, a tropical storm is building, and that seems to describe what Dalio is seeing.
Yes, I agree. I think that's correct. Now, he's a very wise man, and I think he's doing his best to guide us all because he's got far more information and track record than other people. I think he's doing a great job, and I'm a huge fan, I have to say.
I read his last book. It's fabulous. Robin, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, you have a new newsletter that's published. Tell our listeners about it.
Yeah, it's the English company is called South Bank Research, and they are publishing it. And my newsletter is called Dynamic Trend Alert. And South Bank Research is related to the Agora Press, which is an American company. And they do lots of newsletters for a variety of people. Anyway, I like the company. I'm happy to be working with them. I still do my other newsletter, which is for institutions only. But the Dynamic Trend Alert is available for anybody.
All right. Well, listen, Robin, as always, thanks for joining us. And you have yourself a happy holiday.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
This is the kind of time when astute investors should really start to be getting interested in the market. that there are pockets now of, I think, value starting to appear in this market. But I think it is also a time to be rather astute and to pay attention to why things are pulling back and how much bad news has been priced in relative to how much worse things could potentially get. Then, of course, if the line that we're drawing through all of the things that have been underperforming is interest rate sensitivity, well, what the Fed is going to do next is obviously going to be an enormously important thing that we have to keep an eye on.
Well, the commodity markets have been diverging all year. Up until October, energy has been one star commodity. But what happened? In the month of October and November, we went from gains to one of the steepest declines that we've seen in a long time. Joining me on the program is Robert Rapier. And Robert, I have my own take on why energy fell as quickly as it did, but I'd like to get your take and share it with our listeners as to why you feel the oil dropped precipitously like it did in October and November.
Okay, so here's my take on it. Here's what I think happened. Between last summer, fall, and this summer, I thought oil prices were really unsustainably low, and they did start to climb. And especially with the Iranian sanctions pending, oil prices made a very significant gain year over year. And with the Iranian sanctions getting ready to come online in November, President Trump got Saudi to start pumping more oil. But at the same time, China, who had become a very important export market for U.S. oil producers, I mean, in the summer, we were sending them 500,000 barrels a day. And because of the whole trade war, that export market closed and China stopped importing U.S. oil. And when they did that, inventories in the U.S. started to climb. And when inventories start to climb, price starts to weaken. And so the price was beginning to weaken. Saudi was pumping more oil to make up for the pending Iranian oil that was going to come off the market. And I think at the last minute, President Trump got concerned about higher oil prices. And so he blinked on these Iranian sanctions. And he said, you know what, I'm going to grant waivers to some of these countries, including China, ironically. So U.S. oil producers lost an export market to Iran because these waivers were granted. And Saudi was completely caught off guard. They were not warned in advance this was coming. And so when these waivers were granted, suddenly there's too much oil on the market. And all of that contributed to the extreme precipitous decline of oil. And President Trump has come out and said, you know, I deserve credit for this. And he is correct. He is largely responsible, but Saudi feels double-crossed by this. And, this may have implications in the future, especially since these waivers are supposed to only be for 180 days. I don't imagine Saudi is going to feel like going out and pumping extra oil leading up to the next time the sanctions are supposed to be in effect. I don't believe they're going to trust him so much because they feel like they've been double-crossed. Now, on the other hand, President Trump does have some leverage over them, over this murdered journalist and dissident. And I think he can twist their arm a little bit. And, you know, he's trying to give them a free pass on the murder, saying, you know, they're a very important ally of ours, a very important trading partner. And so he does have that little bit of leverage with them. But, it's hard to say that that's going to offset the billions and billions of dollars that they have lost as a result of this, these waivers that were granted. Saudi immediately came out and said, we're going to take 500,000 barrels a day off the market immediately. And we're going to try to work to get about 1 million to 1.5 million barrels off the market. And I would imagine that they will be successful in doing that. And you will probably see oil prices start to recover. And I don't think where we're at right now is where we'll be in 2019. I think we will climb, back up into the 70s, maybe next year.
Robert, what about the price of oil when you get down to 50? You know, the way I read things, you start going below $50 a barrel, it starts to hurt energy producers, especially when you talk about secondary or enhanced oil recovery, which can be more expensive. You start going below 50, I've heard some like BP say they're okay with $50 oil. But a lot of these smaller shale producers cannot make money when you start going below that.
Yeah, that's correct. And there are oil wells that are being shut in now in some places in the Eagle Ford. We've got some operations down there, and we know of people who are shutting in production at this price because they just can't make enough money to make it worthwhile. But there are places where, you know, the costs have been sunk already. The well's been paid for. They're probably going to keep pumping because they've got is lifting costs. Unless you believe that oil prices are going up. And if you believe oil prices are going up, then, you know, I'm not pumping too much. I'm going to wait until oil prices rise a little bit before I bring production back up much.
So let's talk and go back to prior to the lifting or walking away from the Iranian deal. We had OPEC, which was cutting back production by 1.8 million barrels, and it was starting to work. It dried up the glut in oil. And when we talk about glut, Robert, is this mainly a U.S. issue? Because the U.S. has now surpassed Russia to become the number one oil producer in the world.
Yeah, correct. The loss of the Chinese market caused an issue in the U.S. You can look at our inventories, and they started going up when we lost that Chinese market. Now, China reportedly in October had their highest imports ever. So they didn't stop importing oil. They just started importing it from someone else. So presumably out there, somebody's inventories are going down, but it's not necessarily as transparent in the U.S. But our transparent inventories in the U.S. are starting to climb. So that really started to affect U.S. oil prices first. But because Saudi was pumping more oil and putting more oil out there, there is definitely at the moment too much oil on the market. And Saudi's going to have to go back to, you know, when they engineered this big cut and you know, they're trying to do it again. And when they do that, I think you'll see them recover prices back up to where they like it. I mean, they had prices up above $70. They're happy there. And then all these waivers happened and they got that cut out from under them. To add to that, I would say President needs to get it out of his head that high oil prices are a bad thing. I mean, we are no longer a net importer of, 12.5 million barrels a day. We are approaching zero net imports and potentially net exporter status. And in that case, higher oil prices are actually good for the country. They may cost consumers a little more money, but how is that different from tariffs? You know, tariffs cost individuals more money, but they, in theory, bring production back to the U.S. And same with oil prices. You drive oil prices down, you're going to drive oil production overseas.
And there's another factor that comes in. If you take a look at this economic recovery, Robert, a good majority of the capital investment has come from the energy sector. So if you drive prices lower, yeah, it's great for consumers, but you start shutting down a lot of the wells that you're speaking about. So let's talk about next month. Next month, they'll be meeting in Vienna. What are the chances? I've heard there's sort of like a quiet reduction where basically Saudi Arabia, Russia, they just go back to the oil price reduction that was in place prior to the president asking him to ramp up ahead of the Iranian sanctions. What are the chances that they just basically go back to what they were doing before, which was working?
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. It was working. And I think the chances are very high that they go back to that because they've seen that it was working. And, everybody would be, more than happy to sell a little bit less oil at 75 instead of $50 a barrel. So I think it's highly likely that they'll go back to what they were doing.
Now, when you see the kind of unwinding as we did, whether you were looking at Brent or WTI, where, we were at 77 and we got all the way down to 50. How much of this also was a technical factor where you had a lot of people that were leveraged in the futures market? Everybody was betting on higher prices. I mean, Robert, prior to October, we were talking about $100 oil, and then now they're talking about $40 oil. How much of this was leveraged by hedge funds coming into the futures market and everybody reversing their bets?
Yeah, I said a few years ago that I think that helps drive oil prices down $10 or $20 more than it should, and it helps drive up $10 or $20 more than it should. It increases the volatility when you've got, all these players trying to rush in or rush out. So, I think you wouldn't have seen such a steep decline. I think people panicked especially when the sanctions were given to Iran. I think people really panicked and said, okay, in the short term, oil is not going higher. So let's get out. And yeah, I think the rush out helps drive oil prices down further than they otherwise would be. And it works on the other way too. You know, back in 2008, when oil prices nearly hit $150, I think that was a lot of speculators in the market, probably adding $20, $30 to the price above and beyond what supply-demand fundamentals would have dictated.
I heard, and this was mentioned by not only the Saudis, but others in the energy industry, that so much of what goes on in the trading markets and energy by these macro hedge funds who do not pay much attention to the fundamentals of oil. Because the one thing that I question even myself is in October, when you see the price at $77 and then it drops down to $50, what changed that dramatically in just 1 month?
Right. Just the perception. I mean, the perception that nothing fundamentally changed dramatically enough to move oil that much. But the perception changed, and the perception moved a lot of people out of the oil market.
Well, to me, as I look at this and also what happened to the energy industry, especially energy stocks, Robert, to me, that just, in my opinion, spelled opportunity. When you saw what happened to a lot of these high quality energy producers, I don't care if you're looking at the big international companies or the mid-tiered companies. So what's your perspective in terms of what you see from an, let's say, an investment perspective and the opportunity? Do they remain there? Do you think oil stocks are heading higher with the price of oil?
No, I do believe that. I do believe that this is a buying opportunity. I think the biggest buying opportunity is the segment that I think has been the most overvalued for the last 3 or 4 years, and that's the refiners. The refiners, you know, when oil prices fell in 2014, 2015, the refiners were still outperforming the S&P 500. They were in solid positive territory. They were the only segment of the oil and gas sector that were doing very, very well. And that's because typically when oil prices fall, refiners' margins they can gain a little bit. And the other inverse is true. When oil prices are rising, usually they see their margins shrink some. And this time, when oil prices fell so steeply, the refiners finally had a major correction that they haven't seen in years. And you saw Valero sell off by a third. I mean, I love Valero, but not at the price they traded at. But I think now Valero is a buy. I think some of these refiners are much more attractive than they had been because, you know, they shouldn't have sold off like they did with oil prices. I think their financials will continue to be good. You know, if you look at how Valero performed during the oil price crash of 2014, 2015, they did very well. And, you know, I think some of the ethanol mandates will potentially hurt them some. But the crash in the price of oil, I don't think justified a crash in refiners. So there's a place I think I really look for some value.
Yeah, because you have companies, not only just Valero, you have companies like Phillips 66, a company owned by Warren Buffett. At one point, it's at 122, and then it gets down to 88. And you have to ask yourself, my goodness, if I'm a refiner and the price of the product that I need to make my products drops, I'm going to make more money.
Right. As long as the price of your finished product doesn't drop even more. And that's the other side of the equation. But like I said, typically whenever oil is falling, finished products don't fall as much. I mean, there's a saying in the refining industry, it's like rockets and feathers. Gasoline prices go up like a rocket when oil prices go up, but they fall like a feather when oil prices are going down. And there was a study done a few years ago. It's actually because consumers are more discriminating when prices are going up than they are when they're going down. And they will shop around town, you know, when oil prices are rising and they'll try to save a nickel on the price of gasoline, but going down, they're just happy to see that gas prices are going down. So they don't shop around as much.
Now let's talk about what's happening in the industry itself with stocks, because if you take a look at one of the big increases in corporate profits this year for the S&P, the standout has been the energy sector. Obviously, when you go from $40 oil all the way up to $77 or $86, depending on what you're looking at, that's going to add to your bottom line. Why do you think the market or investors have been shy or reluctant to, let's say, stay in this sector or buy into this sector?
Yeah, so I feel like I'm a, you know, I'm a broken record here, because every time I come on here, I talk about the midstreams and how midstream has really not deserved the beating that it's taken. You know, you've got Enterprise Product Partners, for example. Their cash flow is up dramatically over the last couple of years. You know, Pembina Pipeline is up dramatically, and the share price is exactly where it was. You know, these companies are increasing cash flow by leaps and bounds, and they're not being recognized because there's a general fear of the midstream space, and more specifically, the MLP space. And so I think really that's been a bargain for a long time. They're continuing, you know, you can get 6% dividends in many cases that are covered by cash flow. So, you know, I'm still very bullish on the midstream sector. It's been punished this year. It actually did start to go up when oil prices began to fall. And that's usually not normal price action with the midstreams. But then finally, the price of oil got to the point where even the midstreams started to fall. I'm just looking at Enterprise Products and seeing. So, I mean, they were trading at $30 back, back in the summer, and now they're at $26. So they took a pretty sharp decline whenever oil prices fell. They started to fall in October and shouldn't have.
You know, the thing that really strikes me about this is how much of this is psychological and perception, because for 2 or 3 years from 2014 all the way to, let's say, this year, the price of oil was low. There was a glut. That's all we talked about was inventories, the global glut. Saudi Arabia and OPEC reacts to that. So the investors were a little shy. Then you start to see prices rise as we did this summer, Robert. And then all of a sudden, in 4 or 5 weeks, you give it all back. So, you know, how much psychologically does that impact investors? In other words, does it make them more shy? I would suspect it does.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the psychology has a bigger impact than even the fundamentals, especially in the oil industry. I mean, you don't see such sharp, dramatic moves in most other sectors just based on the perception that supply or demand has changed. And, you know, that's something I've seen before, where I can watch a company and their cash flow will grow quarter after quarter after quarter, but investors are always expecting trouble further down the line. And so the share price will just fall and fall and fall. And I know a fracking sand company like that, their financials are strong. They get stronger and stronger, and yet the share price is just, it's like it's headed to zero. And it doesn't make any sense, except when you read these news articles that say, you know, the fracking sand market is oversupplied. Well, that may be, but these guys are making money and they're continuing to grow their cash flow. But the expectation is what's driving stock price.
Yeah, psychology can become a trend in itself, because if you take a look at falling oil prices from 2014 all the way to its bottom in 2016, if that perception or that psychology is out there, the minute that, you know, you take a look over the last couple of weeks, you kept hearing, all you heard was inventories were building, there's a glut, there's going to be a new glut, but nobody's looking at, well, if there's a glut and inventories are building, why are they building here and they may not be building elsewhere? So nobody's really looking at the fundamentals and digging into the facts, which I think if you're an investor, spells opportunity.
Right. I mean, these disconnects, they fix themselves after a while. You know, I wrote an article for Forbes back in August, and I was looking at natural gas inventories. And I said, we're headed into winter below the five-year average, below the bottom range of the five-year average. And yet you can buy January, February natural gas for $3 a million BTUs. I said, this doesn't make sense. This is a disconnect. It could stay that way, but any cold weather, any hiccups in supply, there are many, many risks out there that could drive up natural gas prices. And I identified that as an opportunity. I said, if you're a trader right now, natural gas looks like it's not correctly priced. There is a disconnect. And natural gas prices are, for January, February, are up 60% or so since then. So these disconnects fix themselves usually, but not always. I mean, sometimes they can go on for a very long time. So, you know, I try to invest according to fundamentals, but sometimes psychology gets the better of the fundamentals.
Well, the good thing about fundamentals, if you're investing in energy, A lot of these companies, I don't care if you're looking at international or even the mid-tiers, are paying dividends that are 40, 50, sometimes 60% above what you can get in a 10-year treasury. So if you're a patient investor, you can buy cheap, but in the meantime, you're getting a nice dividend to hold you over until the market recognizes that fact.
Yeah, and the problem is, you know, when it's cheap, everybody's afraid. Everybody's afraid. It's just like the refiners right now. Everybody is afraid. Even though I can get Valero for, you know, 30% off, people are thinking, well, what if it goes down more? I mean, it's been going down and down and down, and I'm trying to catch a falling knife, and might it go down 50%? Well, I don't think so, but you're getting it at a 4% yield now. It's something that has just been a cash-generating machine for years and years. And, you know, demand for gasoline in the U.S. remains strong. We're exporting more and more. I mean, the future looks very bright, and yet it's sold off with the price of oil, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
So if I was to sum it up, Robert, you expect that OPEC and especially the Saudis will go back to their production cuts that were in place prior to Trump asking them to increase. So that eventually is going to dry up this surplus. So you expect oil prices higher. And if you were looking at the energy sector, the one that really stands out as a bargain are refiners. Would that be correct?
Yes. And I think the midstream still, I mean, if you're a long-term income investor, midstream still looks very attractive.
All right, Robert, as we close, I know you write for a number of publications from Forbes to Investors Daily, but you also have a newsletter. If our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they can find out more about you.
Yeah, so as you say, I write 7 columns a month for Forbes, focused on the energy industry. I write investment-related columns for Investing Daily, at least one a week, but I also have a subscription column there focused on utilities. And then I have a blog that's just my name, rraypeer.com, where I host most of the articles that I have other places and occasionally write something specifically for that. And those articles often get picked up by the media, and you'll see them in oil price and various places.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Appreciate your explanation in terms of what happened with the price of oil. You have yourself a great holiday and come back and talk again.
You too. Great talking to you.
Thanks, Robert. Bye-bye.
All right. You bet. Bye.
And coming up in hour two, the markets have become more volatile this year despite record corporate profits and a booming economy. One would think with economic and financial conditions this good, the stock market would be doing much better than it has. So why so much volatility? And why is it that this year you can feel rich one month and then poor the next? Well, in hour two, we're going to be answering those questions in what we call things to worry about. Then in the next segment of today's big picture, we look at Trump versus OPEC with the markets that are now worried that a new oil glut is forming as the U.S. is clearly becoming more of a force and the U.S. president, in this case Trump, gaining more power as a result. All of that coming up in hour two, the big picture.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.